Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home. Those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. I was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
All right, all you Aston Villa fans, you've kept this secret long enough. It's time to bring it out into the open. You're going to qualify for next season's Champions League, aren't you? I know you don't want to say it out loud. You'd rather let everyone keep talking about your Man United's, your Newcastle's, maybe even your Brighton's or your Liverpool's, if they go on a late charge. But I see you. I saw you on Saturday ripping Newcastle to shreds, closing the gap behind them to 6 points. Sorry to do this to you, but I feel duty-bound to bring this all out into the open today. Welcome to Monday's Second Captain's Football Podcast. Hi, Ken Heimer.
Hey, Un. How's it going?
Owen, how are you?
Unbeaten in 8 games, 5 wins in a row, and with further matches against top four rivals Man United and Tottenham. I'm nearly discounting Tottenham at this stage, to be honest.
They're
but anyways, I'll call him that. Still to come, who can say for certain Unai Emery won't be leading a team that was barely above the relegation zone when he took charge for the first time in November into the Champions
November.
League.
November, wow.
Next season. It's impressive, isn't it?
It is very impressive, Owen. Do you know when what was number one in the charts the last time Aston Villa won 5 Premier League games in a row?
Well, there's a lot of songs on the charts. What are you saying? What
do you
was
want to
number
give us
one?
The year, or is that...
Well, that makes it a bit too easy, isn't it?
Give us the song and we'll guess the year. Give us the song and we'll guess the year.
I'll give you a strong hint. The last time Aston Villa were on a run of 5 wins in the round of the Premier League was at the same time they were signing the Good Friday Agreement.
Okay,
so it's Spice Girls?
Scar Tissue by the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
As mentioned on the pod last week.
Run DMC. It's like that.
Oh. And that's the way it is.
And that's the way it is. Yeah,
wow.
That was number one for during the entire run. It was number one for 6 weeks.
Was it?
Which fit in the whole Aston Villa run. That's quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
So this is a new and pleasant situation for Aston Villa, particularly against, I have to say, Newcastle United.
I thought you might enjoy that.
Well, I'm sure that Aston Villa enjoyed it as well. And I'm sure that Unai Emery enjoyed it. Because if you remember, Unai Emery had been tapped up to be the Newcastle manager.
Yes.
Until... suddenly, he decided not to be, and they appointed Eddie Howe instead. They had interviewed both of them. This was the story was revisited by Craig Hope in the Daily Mail, who covers Newcastle and other football, where he... I enjoyed the telling of the story, actually. Eddie Howe went to bed thinking he was out of the running, and he woke up to the news that actually he was the Newcastle manager. Howe was waking to the school run in another day of unemployment. The dad of three is not prone to bad language. On this occasion, however, a fucking get in was excused. He took a deep breath, kissed goodbye to his wife Vicky and his sons, and entered what he later called work mode.
I'm sorry, just to clarify, he wasn't saying to the kids, fucking get in there, I've got work to do.
No, was
get into that
get
school
in.
On the school run, fucking get in there.
Newcastle have just called me and told me that. Today, Howe may well look back on what might have been. For the first time, he will come up against the man whose change of heart altered the course of his own destiny. He is 17 months on, infinitely richer in bank balance and reputation. Without a doubt, it was life-changing, says the 45-year-old. I always believe your life takes the journey it is meant to go on.
Okay.
I'm not sure everyone's necessarily does, but I suppose it's one way to look at your life, you know? You might as well just, well, look, this is it. Might as well just get on with it, you know? I was due to come here. That is what happened. But I am here because Unai turned the job down. So I'm delighted he did. Fate has a strange way of working. And now we come together. I'm very thankful he made that decision. Although perhaps not thankful that he made the decision to go to Aston Villa, where who flattened Newcastle.
Really did.
Who themselves were on, you know, five wins in a row? I mean, they absolutely smashed West Ham the other week in London, and here they are getting absolutely trampled on by Aston Villa, who could have won by more. I mean, they had a goal, a VAR goal. I mean, it was offside, but it was one of those pretty narrow ones. Yeah. What I like, though, about the story of the Eddie Howe, Unai Emery thing is that, you know, kind of it's a bit like, are you second choice Eddie Howe?
Mm.
Well, not exactly. I mean, Unai Emery apparently got spooked. He had agreed to take the job, and then suddenly all the papers the next day were announcing that he was the new Newcastle manager. And he was like, but I'm not the new Newcastle manager, not yet. And I'm a little perturbed at the way that that's all.
Remember that from the time.
It all just suddenly feels a little, oh, I'm not sure. I'm not sure about this. And so he decided not to go. So Eddie Howe obviously fucking get in. He was there. But what we now know, and this is important, right? Because it seems as though maybe Newcastle appointed their second choice. But no, not really. Sources have long since said that Howe was by far the more impressive interviewee. He identified specific areas for improvement in both the short and long term and explained how he would achieve these goals. It was, say sources, less of a sales pitch and more a practical demonstration. Newcastle's new chairman, Yasir Al-Rumayyan, was sold on the Englishman. Now, that's Yasir Al-Rumayyan. Madison, he's an important man. He's the head of PIF. He's the chair of Saudi Aramco, right? The Saudi national oil producer.
Don't tell me.
Chairman of Newcastle United. Got something to do with LIV Golf, although exactly what is, you know, one of those kind of more, you know.
Depends on what country you're asking the question. Really. Are you an American, by any chance?
But he wanted Eddie Howe. But the thing that you may not have known about Yasir Al-Rumayyan is that he is actually very collegial in his approach. So he's collaborative, he's collegial. He's, above all, a Democrat. And so the fact is that they had agreed to vote on him. And Emery won the vote 3-2.
Right.
Yasir Al-Rumayyan, I get, you know, he voted for the man he's currently got. But when three of the other interviewers said, actually, we want to go for the other guy, he simply held up his hands and said, that's how democracy works.
Yep.
That's absolutely fine. You know,
the people have spoken, the bastards, with a big laugh.
I thought Eddie Howe was absolutely brilliant in that Zoom presentation. He really, I'm considering looking at him for a high, for an important job at maybe Saudi Aramco. Because talent like that shouldn't be left, you know, rotting away doing the school run down in Bournemouth.
No disrespect to the school run, of course.
Of course. But of course, you know, in the end, fate took its course. Emery ended up at Villa, and Aston Villa beat Newcastle United by 3-0. And really have shot up the table. And I see the interesting thing about Newcastle was the kind of rancorous reaction to this, you know.
We'll give you some report on sport music. I will just tell people that I will tell people to sign up for our Champions League coverage. I will ask people, I should say,
of course,
to sign up. Urge people to sign up for World Service membership to hear our coverage of two dead rubbers during the week: Real Madrid versus Bayern Munich, or Bayern Munich versus Man City, and Chelsea versus Real Madrid. Listen, I back Ken to make entertaining podcasts out of the deadest of dead rubbers. That's just the way we go. SecondCaptains.com, Fiverr a month plus VAT. Now continue, please, with your report on sport.
There are other games, of course. Napoli are involved. You know, are they going to make it? Are they going to make it? Inter, Benfica, we can't. I mean, Inter apparently have lost three games in a row for the three home games in a row. Was it without scoring? For the first time since before Aston Villa won five in a row or whatever. But somehow they look like they're going to get to the Champions League semifinals. But yeah, the Newcastle reaction is pretty angry. And it's funny just how quickly this happens, you know? It's like you go from total, like, you know, the as Newcastle and Stella, the Ashley thing, like being buried alive, mm-hmm. right? It's like our club has just been buried alive for 15 years, and that's it. And we sort of can't interact with anything in any way. It's just, we just have to sit here existing, and this is appalling. And now, you know, the Saudi takeover and quite powerful. But it seems as though there's a kind of a rage at now only because Newcastle have only a 75% chance of making the Champions League. Actually, 74% if you look at 538, who do the numbers on these things.
Yep.
They've got a 74% chance of making Champions League, with Brighton at 20, Liverpool at 8, Tottenham at 7, and Villa at only 2.
2% still.
Well, according to this.
6 points to make up, albeit they've played a game more.
Let's just say the last couple of times I've interacted with the 538 probability ranking, you know,
that's also been a little spotty. Election was a long time ago, Murph.
It's been a little spotty, yo. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
But I see Dan Byrne is getting it a little bit. Dan Byrne, obviously.
Local lad.
Well, local lad, but he's a big stick, isn't he? You know?
He's a big unit.
Is he the right shape for a fullback? People are wondering.
Well, he's certainly new,
he's unconventional shape.
People said the same thing about Usain Bolt. Too tall to be a good sprinter. You didn't see Donovan Bailey, hitting his head off door jams, did you? That's what they said, Ken, but they were wrong. And they were wrong about Dan Byrne. He should have been in their World Cup squad, if you asked Dan Byrne.
For me and Freddie Howe, Dan Byrne has played a great season. Mm. But standards at Newcastle are constantly on the up. And so simply being a local lad, a nice man, and who's put in a good season, doesn't necessarily cut it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you lose 3-0.
At the rarefied level.
So we will follow the sort of happiness index there.
Speaking of big units, I know, I'm sure, I don't know if you were going to mention Evan Ferguson's injury, but did you see the Brighton physios?
Oh
my God.
What a rig on him. Well,
there was two of them.
Look at the two of them. I'm showing you a photo here.
I saw the guy on the right.
Absolutely.
The front guy blotted out the guy behind. Because
Ferguson's like, no, I might be all right. I might be able to walk it off. No, you're going off. All right, lads.
Well,
you're the bosses.
You're the...
Absolutely two of the most muscle-bound physios I've seen in Premier League football. So listen, different body shapes, Ken, in different roles. We didn't always think physios had to be quite so well built.
Yeah.
Didn't realise left backs had to be 6'7" tall, but times change, times move on.
Yeah, well, Brighton put on one of the best performances. I mean, partly it's against, you know, Chelsea, Frank Lampard and so on, and it's three defeats in a row now.
It was a nice batter though, wasn't it?
What?
Welcome home, Super Frank.
It was draped
over like nearly the entire length of one of the stands behind the goal.
It wasn't much of it. There didn't seem to be that much. Like,
I mean, come on. Like,
even Lampard had the good sense to walk out and not even wave. Just go straight to the Brighton bench and then go to the Chelsea bench.
The stats, like he's won one of his last 17 matches or something as manager. Mm. Like, it's amazing. You know, that's really appalling. Like, I mean, what's the...
And the Chelsea team is hilarious. Like, the bench was hilarious. How many good players were on the bench on Saturday?
Yeah. Well, Mudrick at least got an assist, and he's now the assist leader in the Premier League with 2 assists. So at least there's signs of promise. But Brighton were brilliant. Obviously, the bad aspect of it from our point of view is Ferguson getting injured and probably now will not be able to play in the FA Cup semi-final.
Again, it doesn't look long-term, though. You know, it's just a bit like the Fabinho one where... Is this going to be a big one? The one that scuppers his progress doesn't seem to be. It seems to be a couple of weeks.
To be honest, changed by the time I thought it should have been a penalty as well. Because I mean, it was as though the referees were sort of distracted by him getting a good header on it. And did it hit the bar? Was it saved? Or was it both?
That was saved. Yeah. He had an amazing shot earlier on that hit the bar. Tipped on as well.
That was brilliant. And then he sort of injured himself or by the landing. But I also thought he was just kicked across the stomach by the defender. He's nowhere near the ball. I mean, is that, you know, just because he gets a shot on it doesn't mean that, like, getting kicked in the stomach.
I can't remember it through my tears.
No. And now that you mention it, that idiot presenter on Premier Sports didn't bring it up either. So
yeah.
That guy.
He's a lot of these dope people.
Didn't notice it until Ken brought this up now.
But yeah, okay. They play. We're going to talk a bit more about them later and why they seem to have this inexhaustible reserve of talent and ideas. Whether it really is inexhaustible, I suppose, remains to be seen. But I suppose we have to talk a little bit about Arsenal now. You know, So this is apparently the first time they've, Opta were saying, it's the first time they have ever done this, been 2-0 up in two games in a row and ended up not winning. That had never happened before. And so when it does happen, you're sort of like, well, what's the reason? I mean, last week, remember, there was all this, it's the Anfield factor, you know? This is like West Ham. West Ham just lost 5-1 at home to Newcastle. That was their previous home game. They played in midweek in Ghent, I think, whereas Arsenal had the week off. And they've been one of the worst teams in the league all season. You know, we were just talking about Declan Rice last week, you know, and all of the...
fronting up he was doing.
Yeah, he's in, and the reputational damage he's taken as a result of being the front man for this failed enterprise. And yet... 2-0 down, and you can already hear the crowd, you know, going, and then it just all comes apart for Arsenal again. And, you know, I mean, I think it's hard to conclude that this pressure isn't getting to them. I mean, you know, Arteta was saying afterwards, you know, Saka obviously missed a penalty. Look, if you take penalties, you're going to miss penalties. I mean, you've missed a few, right? Have you missed? Have you actually missed?
I missed one against Dunmore in 2001, and then I missed one against Raheny in 2020.
Missed a 14-yard free from front.
Two misses nearly 20 years apart.
A couple of years off in between, but yeah. Fair, I mean, a large number
Fair
of
Play
years.
Cup 2017 or so? Did you not miss there as well?
Oh, I think I did miss there, yeah, but I mean, it's so hardly a competitive.
Well, no.
It's not a competitive.
Well, it was a semi-final. So one step away from the final.
I thought the worrying moment for Saka was, I mean, the penalty, you've seen players miss them. Missing the goal altogether seems to be a thing that people do more now these days. And there's obviously Kane, Salah did it twice. Even Luis Suarez did it the other night. You know, Luis Suarez is having this kind of fun late career venture at Gremio, whatever. And he's every time I look on the internet, there's another goal by him. But this one, he blasted the ball over the bar. Okay, it happens, but... When Saka in the second half ended up, he got the ball. There was a break. I don't know if you recall this moment in the game where he's running through, and it was a 3-on-2 break. And you're like, okay, here's the goal. And Saka just made a complete mess of it, just in a very uncharacteristic way. That I just think this is a guy who looks exhausted.
He shot, didn't he? He sort of cut inside and took it on himself. Was that the one?
Yeah. And he had two teammates well positioned. So usually he's going to commit a defender and play in one of them or find some answer to this, but he didn't. He kind of just, in an uncharacteristic for Saka way, just kind of failed to come up with a solution and gave away the chance. And it's at a moment like that, you're like, this guy has actually played so much this season. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Even Southgate like keeps playing him. Like, you know, for against Ukraine or whatever he was playing recently. He played both the internationals for England recently. You kind of like, maybe... I'm almost a little surprised Arteta doesn't find an injury to, you know, I'm sorry, Bukayo, but it seems to me as though your back might be a little bit sore and you might not be able to go on international duty for these March games. You know what I mean? It just sort of seems a bit like, what are you doing to him? But, I mean, if you look at him actually in the league, the only players younger than him who have played as many minutes or more are Declan Rice and Mark Guehi, who are obviously one's a defensive midfielder, one is a central defender. There isn't anyone under 25 who's played more minutes than him. And the only players who are his age who have played similar minutes are Brennan Johnson, the Nottingham Forest player, and Martinelli, his teammate, right? So Arsenal have got a problem here, I think. When you look at City... This is the game. I mean, Haaland gets taken off at halftime. Like the City game on the weekend, for those of you who watched it, followed the pattern that it looked like the Arsenal game was going to follow, except City actually finished the job.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, though. I mean, and perhaps we should have been taking a bit more cognizance of it all the way along, but this is always going to be a struggle for Arsenal. I mean, they don't have the resources that City have, quite obviously, and therefore they are going to have to play all their players... Probably give them more minutes than this. What I'd imagine that if it is a fatigue issue, I'm sure the sports science guys are noticing it as well, and maybe politely bringing Mikel Arteta's attention to it. But what's he going to do?
He can't. You can't leave Saka out.
It's too late now.
He left him out against was it Leeds recently because we're playing at home. I think we can win this, and they did win. And he came on sort of late, but realistically, like, you can't leave him out. He's the best player in the team, right? There are a few candidates for that, I guess, at Arsenal this season. But I think he is a player who, more than anyone else, allows them to unlock a game against the team that's defending. You know what I mean? He can do so many different things. It's so difficult to defend against when he's obviously in top. I mean, he wasn't like this against West Ham. You know,
some Arsenal fans would say Odegaard has been their best player.
Odegaard has been.
Martinelli is an outside chance there as well.
Yeah, the reason that Arsenal are where they are is these guys have been playing brilliantly. But Arteta, I think, has made fewer changes than any other manager. They've still used more players than Man City, I think, but they don't. Some of these players are real kind of, fringe players. Guys like Kivior or Suarez or Cedric Suarez or Lekonga and you know what I mean. Nelson. They're not. Yeah. It's not like we're City have kind of. City might have Bernardo Silva on the bench. You know, City will have Mahrez on the bench. You know, they're slightly different. And the way that City are going at the moment, I mean, has kind of... I mean, remember the first half of the season, we're sort of like, well, you know, Haaland being in the team means the team is quite different. Guardiola isn't really keen on it. They're letting in, they're scoring more, but they're also letting in more, and they're letting in more than the increase in what they're letting in is bigger than the increase in what they're scoring. Okay, that's now changed. Because he basically found a way to do it. He's found the system that allows him to control the game and also have Haaland just doing his thing.
Yeah.
And at this point, I don't really see how. I'm interested to see if anybody can stop this now, because what Haaland is doing is just beyond. Like, I mean, he equaled Salah's record. He's still got like eight or seven matches to go. I mean, Guardiola's taken him off at halftime, or he would have, I'm sure, scored another goal or two, and is emerging as like head and shoulders above every other player in world football at the moment. Yeah. I mean, this guy is like, I mean, when have you ever seen anything?
Well,
like
Haaland, sorry. We don't have to do the Mbappe comparison again.
Well, I mean, Mbappe, like, where is Mbappe? You know?
Back healing beautifully for a Lionel Messi goal that I saw on Saturday night.
Who were they playing?
It was either Lens or Lille.
It was Lens.
Or Lyon. Certainly one of those three.
No, it was Lens, I believe. Or the slag heaps of Lens were lit up by the brilliance of the PSG.
You never miss a chance to mention the slag heaps of Lille, do you?
Well, I've seen them.
You're always sticking the boot into Lille.
Slag heaps of Lens. Have you ever been to Lens?
No.
Well, I have. And I'll tell you, those slag heaps are impressive. They're properly conical, you know what I mean?
God. Mm. They've gotten a really bad rep over the years, haven't they? Slag heaps.
I was surprised by how sort of tall and... They're like traffic cones.
There's our title for the podcast anyway today. The slag heaps of Lille.
Lens.
Hey, listen. Arsenal are going to... Look, this is well set up now, right? Because it was always going to come down to this Man City-Arsenal game. Now Arsenal have to get a point. At least.
It kind of doesn't, matter.
And they needed to get a point. But
this 2-2 draw doesn't really matter. Arsenal needed the draw.
It doesn't change what Arsenal have to do.
Except for all the other hard games they have to play, like you guys. But no, my point about the City game is, you know, if they had won all these other games, gone there, gotten a stuffing, and would it have been a real league title if they'd had the double done over them by Man City? Would Arsenal fans have been happy to accept that?
I mean, it's happened. You know, you can. There have been instances of that happening.
Whereas now, they could be league champions having had some amazing results at Man City. That's the positive spin to put on Arsenal today.
Well, if they beat Man City, then they're in a great position.
If they beat, absolutely.
At the moment, it just doesn't look as though they're capable of doing that.
But Arsenal were going to have to win all their games.
If Rob Holding
against Man City, to use the phrase, it's still in Arsenal's hands.
If it's going to be Rob Holding against Erling Haaland,
it's good night.
Yeah, it's hard to see how they can do that. And then it becomes this. I don't know if you saw this argument between like Gary Neville and Hasselbank and Keane, where we're talking about whether it was going to be a disaster for Arsenal not to win the league. It's a disaster. Which, I mean, And I think it was Neville disagreeing, saying, no, it's not. I mean, how can you say that? You know, they've had a great season, blah, blah, blah. It is a disaster, says Jimmy, because like you're winning and then suddenly you don't. It doesn't matter what it was at the beginning of the season. What matters is you were there, you had the chance, and then suddenly it's not going to happen. Mm. I don't know. I kind of feel like he's sort of right about that. Like, I mean, the thing is that Arsenal, when you look at them, have got the youngest team in the division, right? That's so this is a team which should keep getting better. That's, you know, there is plenty of evidence for that. But you don't know that that's ever going to happen. You only get a certain number of goals at this kind of a situation.
Yeah. I kind of think if City beat Arsenal, right, and then move away from them and get the job done with a few games to spare, it might feel like less of a disaster than if there's a Gerrard moment in the last couple of games or something like that. Do you know what I mean? It's almost like if they get put out of their misery early on, and if Man City win that game, everyone is it's gone, you know, like that's the way. And maybe there's, you get to the end of the season and you can think, well, we gave it a shot and we weren't, but whereas if nearly the closer you get to something, the worse it's going to feel. Maybe. If you,
and you know, I was going to start saying stuff like, well, Liverpool, Chelsea, United will never be as bad as they are this season, but honestly, Liverpool and Chelsea could actually be as bad next season.
Yeah.
You know, like, it seems to me like both of those are multi-year projects. United might be a bit better. Newcastle will probably be a good bit better. I mean, it might not be a complete disaster when you think about it, in that they should be good enough to challenge again next year.
Yeah.
But geez, they were in an unbelievable position.
I mean, Arsenal have had this situation themselves before. I mean, these teams that were always going to be next year's team, you know, Fabregas and Van Persie and Adebayor and Kleb, you know, those teams, and Nasri, these guys who were going to be even better next year. And actually, they just all ended up joining Man City or Man United or Barcelona. You know, it just dissipated. So, it's a tough situation. Well, look, there are more games still to go. I see that Juan Laporta is doing a press conference today, where he, I believe for the first time, is actually speaking to the press about the Negreira, El Caso Negreira. This is the one where they paid all the money to the vice president of the Referees Association or whatever, but it was simply for reports.
For consultancy work.
Yeah. And he's done lots of comments in like private settings, or he goes to see like the Barca Superfan Association in whatever town he's in, and then he gives a speech about how Barcelona are the victims of a conspiracy, and everyone cheers, and then he walks out of the room. But this is the first time he's actually speaking to the media and taking questions, which apparently has been going on for some time. He did sort of stall out by saying that Javier Tebas, the La Liga president, has participated in public lynching of FC Barcelona. That's how he characterizes the situation. Warning that submissiveness is not synonymous with Juan Laporta. He says this according to Tariq Panja. He's following that a few times. But they're basically saying, or I mean, it's just a 100% stonewall denial accusation of conspiracy on behalf of all of his supposed enemies. So Real Madrid are a historically favored organization, he says. So it's kind of it's a bit rich to hear from them that we're trying to, simply because we paid this man 7.3 million euros, which, according to Tariq, he said, it sounds like a lot, but it was paid over 18 years. So just because we paid this guy 7.3 million, you know.
I mean, sure, if we paid him for over one season, but the fact that we've paid him for almost two decades surely lessens our culpability in the eyes of the public.
The point that Tariq makes is these reports must have been seriously high quality. In total, 7.3 million euros paid would work out at something like 10,000 euros per report over the 18-year period. So, I mean, we would all do this. I'm pretty sure this is the problem Barcelona have, is that you could get anybody, even a very highly qualified person. It doesn't just have to be like someone's nephew who's on work experience. You could actually hire a top professional to compile reports on referees for a lot less than 10 grand per report over an 18-year, you know. So the question still remains: why did it have to be the vice president of the referees body that you paid all this money to do? You know, so there doesn't really seem to have been any answers. So they're basically saying There's no question here that we did anything. You can't prove that we did anything to influence sporting outcomes. You know, so just because we were paying this guy doesn't mean that he then did us any refereeing favors. And there's a kind of a hint that Barcelona may have been stitched up by some of their own directors in a kind of a that the scheme was that was a sort of a circular thing where, like, you
it's
know,
the call is coming from inside the house.
Yeah. Sort of two for you, one for me, kind of a thing. You know, this might have been, but of course, since Juan Laporta was also the president for a whole previous period of this, I mean, it's still. It's difficult for him. Anyway, that thing is still going on as we record. And we'll see, I suppose, tomorrow if there's anything really stunning, any stunning developments out of it.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're concerned about mental health or looking to get into self-improvement, join me at the Piece by Piece podcast. There, I'm interviewing everyday people and experts alike about how to overcome difficulties around mental health. Speaking of which, I just released an interview with a mental health historian and another with two friends who are healthcare workers.
If these conversations interest you, check us out at Piece by Piece. That's Piece with an A, B-I, and then Piece with an I. Thank you so much.
It's very difficult to see Arsenal play one day without Arsenal on the bench.
He's going to ruin the club, fam. He's going to ruin the club, lad. I'm telling you, fam.
But up and down the land, you do sense a genuine appreciation for the way this Arsenal team play. They were perfect.
It's turning. It's turning, blood. Did you hear the boos at full time? Seriously, shut the fuck up tonight. I'm not in no mood for no little dickheads chatting shit.
We love to have him there all the time, but we all know that's not going to happen. One day he's going to have to go.
Spineless, where were they in the second half? Spineless, no fucking character, no fucking leadership. Where does that boil down to? It boils down to the fucking manager. He's finished.
It will be hard. He's not thinking of leaving one day.
He was a great manager. He's gone. He's gone.
It will happen eventually. We all know it. But I don't see it.
Arsenal Football Club, man.
For me, the day I will see Arsenal play without Arsenal on the bench, it's going to be weird.
The fan base of this fucking club.
Don't try to question my fan base. No. Don't try to question my fan base, okay?
Fan base.
You can't listen.
I can't get angry like I did before because it's just.
Arsene Wenger's team, every bit as good as the manager's words. He had no doubts. They are the champions. They have taken the title away from Manchester United, and they have done it here at Old Trafford. It does not get more conclusive than that.
It's the Independent's Miguel Delaney and Jack Pitbrook of The Athletic this week on the weekend that Arsenal blew their title chance. Is that a fair way to start this chat, Jack?
No, not quite, but it's not looking good, is it? I mean, it's not just that they have to basically win every remaining game, I think, or at least avoid win the rest and avoid defeat to Manchester City. But I think the manner in which they've been well ahead in the game against Liverpool, which is one thing, but West Ham United, which is a game which I think everyone was pretty sure they would win, or at least I was, and then to completely lose control of the game in the way that they did. And then, of course, to miss that great chance to go 3-1 up, and with that, surely would have been the game. It does make you pretty anxious, doesn't it, about their capacity to get over the line.
Miguel, is it a bit of are they beginning to choke, to use that word, or is there something else? Is it simply fatigue? They've played a lot of the same players for a large part of this season.
Well, I think there's three elements to this, really. First of all, I definitely think yesterday, and to a certain degree against Liverpool, they suffered from key absences, especially in defence. I mean, yesterday, it was pretty clear that without Saliba there, Mikel Antonio really fancied running at Rob Holding. Same for Jarrod Bowen against Kieran Tierney. And also, beyond that, given that this wasn't his usual backline, I thought Ramsdale was a lot more... I mean, he's been quite commanding this season, Ramsdale.
He was brilliant in the previous game.
Yeah, and but yesterday I thought he was all over, but he started flapping at corners, which kind of fostered the sense that a West Ham equaliser was coming before it did. I think all of that is connected to something bigger, which I think in this game, I wouldn't go so far with the Liverpool game because I think that was maybe specific to the circumstances. But in this game, I think it would be fair to say that they choked, they bought whatever phrase you want to use. But I think it was pretty clear. I thought from even the minute before the West Ham penalty, they were sort of short circuiting as we were discussing off air before, Ken. Things that Arsenal have been doing so well this season, they just stopped doing. Because even after the game, Arteta referenced how they started the game with a sense of flow, but that obviously went. But I think that's connected to something bigger, which is, I mean, A, it's their first title challenge, or this team's first title challenge, which brings its own kind of learning experience. But equally, there's the context, which is the inherent knowledge that at this point, against a city on this form, it was like they were suddenly aware of the immense stakes. I mean, for most of Premier League history, 2-2-all draws, even allowing for the comeback nature of them, would kind of be just, you know, drop-offs that contribute to the drama. But in the last decade, and especially in the last half decade, as Guardiola and City have kind of come to this final stage of what they are, it's pretty much fatal.
Yeah. You know, but I don't know. I mean, I wonder what you think happened between the, you know, if we could look at that period when Arsenal, because this is the second time it's obviously happened in a row, 2-0 up, playing brilliantly, 2-0 up, looks like you're going to win 4-0, you know, everything's going great. And then something goes wrong. And Arteta said after the game, we made a huge mistake. You know, we didn't keep playing for the third, the fourth goal. And I was kind of thinking, yeah, I agree, but you're not a pundit. Like, you're the actual guy in charge here. Is there nothing that he can do to impress on, to change the pattern? Is this just something that, like, kind of the team has to get through by itself, the knowledge of this kind of situation, the pressure that they're under? Or has Arteta himself kind of helped to enable these collapses?
Well, I do wonder whether this is a little bit related to how Arteta coaches. And it's also actually been something that's been seen in, and this is entirely consistent, given that Arteta's worked under Guardiola, but something we've seen in some of Manchester City's their Champions League collapses, in that these teams are so supremely coached that when things start to go wrong or go against what they expect, they don't necessarily know how to react.
But why does that follow, though? I mean, surely a team that's well coached should also be coached to react to, oh, you know, we have to go to plan B now, but that's okay because we're well coached.
But I think it's so automated, and it's sort of games going into kind of areas that are just totally, I mean, the last two Arsenal games basically descended into chaos that we've seen in City's Champions League games as well. And I thought there was, I mean, this obviously doesn't explain it, but I thought it was interesting after the game when Arteta was asked about all this, and you kind of sense this a little bit of conflict in him, in that obviously he wants to lay into the mistakes they made and address that. But then Arsenal's whole title challenge has been about this kind of supreme, this kind of very modern element of coaching, of confidence in what you're doing, focus on what you're doing. And even what he said, we have to just remind them how good they've been, basically to keep about the process. But of course, the process maybe takes you, as we've seen with City in Europe, until this season perhaps, it takes you 85 to 90% of the way, but there's still that remaining 10%. And maybe that is something that comes with experience, with and not least with Arteta himself, because I think some of his decisions in-game in the last two matches maybe been a little bit surprising, although he obviously has his own logic for them.
What about, I mean, I think we talked about the Liverpool game, but what about yesterday's game struck you as, I'm not sure about that?
Once again, actually, I suppose he took off Gabriel Jesus for physical issues, but taking off Odegaard again, for the second game in a row when they actually needed something, and in both instances they had moments where an Odegaard pass would have potentially opened up the opposition on a break, and he wasn't there. Again, I mean, maybe it was more explicable in the Liverpool game, given he was trying to adapt to the to what Liverpool were doing to them, but it felt like it ceded advantage at the time, especially to go so defensive, that then cost them when it finally inevitably went to 2-2.
Yeah, Jack. I mean, I can see today there's a bit of bargaining going on with Arsenal fans who are kind of trying to. I mean, everyone can sort of see the pattern. The pattern of the season is now uncomfortably like you've gone 2-0 up in a game and suddenly it's 2-2. Oh no! And it's the kind of, you know, nobody expected Arsenal to be in this position. I think they were 66-1 to win the league, and now they've still got a great chance of doing it, but not as good a chance as they had a couple of weeks ago. How do you think they should reflect on this if they end up losing it in the final stretch? This is something they were never expected to win, and yet they were in a great position, and maybe it's not going to happen. And if that happens, how do you think they should reflect on this?
Well, I think they should reflect on it with a lot of pride, because it's obviously a big achievement given, you know, what happened last season where they missed out on fourth place. I don't think anybody would have expected them to be there. That said, I think it'll be really, really painful. I mean, remember, Arteta's Arsenal always reminded me a bit of a kind of slightly better back version of Pochettino's Tottenham, or at least in the first few years, where, you know, you've got this, the club's been a bit of a mess for a while, and then you get in this new young manager who's got a clear idea about how he wants football to be played, and he gets rid of the old players who don't agree with it, and he brings in new players who are really, you know, who look like they worship the ground that he walks on. But I think the problem that they have, like Pochettino's Tottenham, is, well, firstly, as Miguel said, they don't really, you know, they've never been in this position before, and so they don't have that experience to fall back on. And secondly, also, as Miguel said, they're so kind of invested in the truth of plan A and the methods that they've been following over the course of the season that when things start to wobble, they find it very, very difficult to come back after things go wrong. I mean, it's impossible to watch Arsenal at the moment and not think of, you know, Tottenham at the end of 2015-16, where they confounded everyone's expectations, but were eventually, Leicester City were just a bit better than them. Tottenham couldn't come up, and then their heads went at the end of the season. I don't know what's going to happen over the last kind of 6-7 games of this season, but at the moment it feels like, you know, the situation is just getting out of their grip.
Well, listen, Miguel, when it all falls apart for Mikel Arteta at Arsenal, they can always go calling the manager of Aston Villa, Unai Emery, for an emotional return to the club. This guy, I'm obsessed with Aston Villa this weekend. They've snuck into this position. Nobody's really talked about them. Nobody's really talked about them. That's what everyone says about every team that they don't feel has had enough coverage. We haven't really talked about them, is what I should say. I mean, he took over. His first game, I was looking back at it, was beating Manchester United 3-1. Their first away win in the league, first home win in the league against Man United for 27 years. We should have realised then something was up. They had a wobble when they lost about three in a row a while back, but that was against the likes of City and Arsenal and so on. They've now won 5 in a row, unbeaten in 8. They have got Man United and Spurs still to come. Were they to win those games, is it totally outlandish to suggest that Unai Emery could lead Aston Villa from basically just above the relegation zone into the Champions League, having taken over mid-season?
Well, I think the line that has to be said, given who they're facing at the weekend, what a job Unai Emery's done, by the way.
Oh, really?
First of all, given Beal left in the summer, and I know this was a bit of a debate with it around Villa at the start, but basically Villa lost any semblance of tactical structure a bit under Jenner, that can be seen in the results. They first of all benefited from that, and secondly, I would put Emery, I mean, the story of his career, but he's possibly the best of that kind of second tier of managers just outside the
what's all this second tier talk?
Well, I mean, look, he's basically the Europa League's Unai Emery. What is the Europa League if not a second tier competition? But that isn't a discount. He's a very good manager. Very tactically astute. He's put shape on Villa. I do think they've benefited now. I mean, even the fact that five successive wins puts you on the brink of the Champions League in a way that possibly wouldn't have been the case for a lot of the last decade. Because, I mean, this can't be discounted either. For as good as he's done, to jump from just above the relegation zone to where he is now is remarkable. But obviously, it's a little bit of a 2015-16 bar the title race in that we're having horror seasons for all of Chelsea, Spurs and Liverpool. That does create an opening, but they're fully benefiting from it. And every single player looks transformed. In the classic, and they're transformed because every player has a very clear idea in that system, which is, I suppose, what the fundamentals of coaching are all about.
Does Ollie Watkins, Jack, have any weaknesses?
He's amazing, isn't he? He's already looking like the best of all the non, or along with Marcus Rashford, the best of all the non Harry Kane English strikers. Like most of the English strikers that Southgate has to choose from who are not Kane are generally like big number nines who you would hit it up to, whether that's Abraham, Bamford, Calvert-Lewin, etc. Whereas Watkins is completely electric, isn't he? Because he actually runs in behind defenders and gives them, I guess as Rashford does, and gives them problems there. He's been incredible recently. Like I genuinely never thought he was as good as he is looking right now, in not just in terms of his movement, but in terms of his finishing and kind of an all-round team and link-up play too. He's amazing.
Miguel, you mentioned that Chelsea is one of the teams who are allowing the likes of Villa and Brighton and these sides to have a sniff of a Champions League place. I mean, I covered the Brighton game at the weekend. It was incredible. And actually, even thinking back to the Spurs, I don't know how Spurs won the game last week against Brighton, because they were really good that day, but they just absolutely outplayed a team who've spent £600 million on players over the last few months or over the course of the season. Is De Zerbi a sort of managerial genius? I saw Stephen Kenny saying on the international break that he's never seen anyone use a system, play a system of football the way that De Zerbi does.
I think from that perspective, he's genuinely seen as innovative in football. One of the first very new things tactically has almost come in the last 5 years.
And what is a new thing though? What exactly are they saying?
Well, in terms of inviting attack, like people often talk about in coaching circles, talk about the immense risk of this, which is why it's such a brave system, which is basically inviting attacks into very dangerous areas and then hitting there. And it's something to that depth not really seen. And something that has been it's made Brighton so dangerous. Again, there's potentially a second season issue where people have rumbled it, but that's something to come. For the moment, and I think because this goes beyond De Zerbi, it's really about the people that picked De Zerbi as well. Brighton should be a model club, especially you can get into bigger debates about ownership and that, but in terms of how they've sustainably built themselves up through correct choices, through good structure, and then through very good appealing football, especially if you consider what they played under Chris Hughton only 5 years ago. No disrespect to Chris Hughton.
Well, it is that quite should be a model. But
I mean, it wasn't always best to watch. But again, and Brighton, I mean, whatever we're saying about Villa, Brighton would potentially be on the brink of a Champions League football themselves had it not been for the totally opposite model, which is another state-owned club, Newcastle, occupying one of those places, which should be a big discussion, especially what we're talking about with the title race as well. But then I don't really want to get into that right now. It's more about also what Brighton are doing. I mean, look, one of the first moves that Newcastle made, appointing Dan Ashworth.
Yeah.
Ashworth. So Brighton have lost Ashworth. They've lost Potter. They've lost, what, 3-4 key players over the last year?
Ben White, Cucurella.
They've lost other coaches, other executive staff. And despite that, they haven't just kind of sustained. They've actually got better while playing better football. Evidently, the recruitment team is remarkable. And it's a real story for the season, that. And especially with all the kind of the issues in modern football we've talked about so much on the show and elsewhere, that is something to look at and to seek to replicate.
You got a good look at Brighton recently, Jack, I guess. Tottenham beat them 2-1 in what, I suppose in hindsight, is one of the most impressive results in Spurs' history. But, you know, they obviously lost that day. There was some the referees ended up apologising to them, so that was obviously a part of the story. But how do you think they're doing this? I mean, as Miguel says, they've kind of supplied half the league with players and technical staff and coaches and so on. And somehow they just keep improving.
Yeah, I mean, it took a bizarre combination of refereeing and VAR decisions in that game to help Tottenham win. I mean, it was the most... they were very, very unfortunate not to have won that game. But I think overall, as Miguel says, the Brighton strategy just shows the huge inbuilt advantage it is, even now in the Premier League, being clever, like being able to think strategically, know exactly what you're trying to do, do your research with the help of analytics, looking at all sorts of different profiles of people you're trying to bring in. And having a plan in case things go wrong. I mean, so many...
Sounds incredibly obvious.
So many Premier League clubs don't run themselves that way. So many Premier League clubs go for, you know, who's a sexy, famous manager that we've heard of that we can appoint, and then we can retrofit the strategy around him? Who's a famous player that we would, you know, we've seen play on TV and we'd like to bring into the club? Like, it's the level of thinking in Premier League clubs is so low that all it takes is Brighton and Brentford to actually put a little bit of thought into what they're trying to do, and they can confound the whole model, even with the huge kind of upward drag caused by the resource imbalance in the Premier League. So even though Brentford and Brighton lose so many people higher up the pyramid, because of course as soon as anyone does anything well, they get stripped, they manage to turn that into an advantage because that creates money which they can then continue to use intelligently. It's amazing how well they've done over the last 5 years or so, but it's kind of damning of English football. The what a huge advantage that simply being clever is, because everybody else is so stupid.
Although,
that's essentially what money does, isn't it? I mean, I remember that's something I've heard within football a few times. Basically, that a lot of money makes you stupid. Now, that's not true of, say, Manchester City, but pretty much kind of best in class, as the phrase goes, in nearly everything. But the game that Jack is referencing there, that almost shows the biggest contrast in that Brighton go from managers. They have with every element of the team, from centre back to the manager itself, they know exactly what they're looking for. It fits into an existing profile and hopefully can make that profile evolve too, which I think is pretty key in this. With Spurs, well, Brighton know exactly what they are. Spurs, and this is, you could say this with a few clubs, including up until maybe recently Manchester United, say, they don't really have a clear idea of what they want to be. Essentially, through Levy, they think they're a big six club, but they're really one of those clubs in the tier below who work best when they're trying to be upwardly mobile, almost like a higher scale Brighton. And hence, they've had their best success under a manager who exactly fits that profile. But they've suffered the greatest disappointment. And as Jack points to there, two big name managers, and one of them in Conte, who was just never going to be a fit because he had greater demands than what they could offer. And as soon as you get into that, where there's kind of disconnections in between different parts, and obviously it was really pronounced with Conte, that's when things start to fall apart.
Yeah. Well, you know, things have a way of falling apart in due course, you know, even when you're doing things really well, that doesn't mean that you're still going to be doing things well in a couple of years. And I'm struck by the contrast between Brighton and a club who that used to get a lot of credit for some of the same type of stuff, but that's no longer the case, which is Liverpool. And just the way in which Brighton can bring in a player like Enciso, a 19-year-old Paraguayan who scores one of the best goals of the season, you know, beats Chelsea at Stamford Bridge. This kind of thing has been happening all season. You know, Karim Mitoma, you know, a player who was, let's say, unheralded, right, has been absolutely sensational, one of the best players
Evan Ferguson, of course.
Another great thing, well, he decided to go to Brighton rather than Liverpool, which looks like a sensible decision. But just on Liverpool, I know there was the whole Bellingham drama this week, and apparently some bad-tempered exchanges between Klopp and some of the journalists covering that. You know, their struggle to sign players, this is the thing they used to be good at. But it seems as though a kind of an obsession with the perfect player is leading them to disregard all of the perfectly good players with potential. You know, the kind of player they used to sign, like Wijnaldum or Matip or Firmino or Andy Robertson, And they've got into this weird zone where, like, you know, the fans, a lot of the fans want them to spend, like, you know, a world record fee on Bellingham when actually they need about five or six players. What is your kind of take on how they've managed to go from clever to stupid in such a short space of time?
I mean, is there an element of kind of, I'm going to quote The Dark Knight Rises here, but victory defeating them in some way? Well, in the sense that they've got used to a certain level. And they're now, they've come back around to the other side of the cycle and they're not primed for it. First of all, there's been a lot of shifts in the personnel behind the clock. Secondly, I forget who said this to me, so apologies to who, but I think it's a very good line in that now Liverpool are at the point where rather than looking at a player's potential and accepting their flaws because they see how they develop, it's like, as you said, they almost want the perfect ready-made player. And the perfect ready-made player often costs a lot of money. And this is one of the things that's kind of struck me about the whole Bellingham thing as well, in that especially when, and this is the club's fault to a certain degree because of how much this has been built up, all the kind of stuff about the amount of players talking to him in the England camp, all of that. But there's always another player. Mm. But unless you're talking about, say, Messi or at this point, Haaland and Mbappe, there's always, I mean, look at the example across the league. Arsenal were so desperate for Mudrick in January. They went for Trossard, who's worked out better. And again, it comes back to that. Whereas, Bellingham might have represented a certain ideal about exactly what they wanted, but they can just adapt and it can maybe fit in to what they're doing. I mean, people will obviously point to kind of Alisson and Van Dijk as, you know, previous representations of Bellingham were that exactly ideal player. But that was at a different stage of the process. Van Dijk and Alisson were very specific final pieces of the jigsaw where that was more understandable. I mean, whatever, the pieces are all over the place at the moment. They're building again, and that doesn't necessitate the same exact perfect player for that price in that role. In some ways, Klopp actually has a bit of freedom now to build again. As a matter, maybe that's been reflected in actually some of the other names that we're seeing being spoken about.
Sorry, which names are you talking about?
Well, in terms of, like, you know, I mean, basically there's a strand of 30 to 60 million pound midfielders that aren't Bellingham's level, but potentially can work very well under Klopp. I mean, one of them is actually Conor Gallagher. I know I wrote it actually 2 weeks ago. And when that went out, I can't say it was exactly an enthusiastic response from Liverpool fans.
So one of your articles, Miguel. I can't believe.
It wasn't the subject of the article. It was the the interest in the player.
Yeah.
but he's also under Klopp in 2017. Again, I suppose we're into bigger questions now about whether Klopp can build a new team again, and that's something way beyond what we're talking about. But under Klopp in 2017, you could actually see Gallagher being exactly that sort of player that could do very well under him. Similarly, some of the other names we're looking at, Paulinho at Fulham, Thuram, the younger Thuram. And again, Liverpool's great virtue before they brought in these big signings in Alisson and Van Dijk was turning this sort of strand of £30 million player into something worth much more than that.
Yeah. Just on that, Jack, I'm sure that Miguel's Conor Gallagher story was responsibly sourced. Klopp was arguing with journalists in his press conference and he kind of went into one of these you are fake news modes and some of the journalists didn't like that. I wondered, have you ever been accused of fake news by a manager, and if so, do you take it personally when it happens?
No, not to my face.
would you take it as a brutal and bilious insult?
No, I think in part you probably think it was good that the manager had been annoyed by something that you'd written. One, because it shows that they're reading you, and two, because, you know, generally, as long as you're confident in what you've written, it shows that you kind of rattled them, or rather you've written something which they've hopefully has pissed them off because they know it's true. I've certainly had situations where I've written something which I knew was true and it went down very badly with various former Tottenham managers. And I was pleased to know that I'd kind of landed a punch in the right place.
Do you
on that though? Yeah, so, managers barely know who we are, and in fact,
that's very true.
It is amazing.
It's like a Homer Simpson, Mr. Burns dynamic. It's like you've seen me every day for the last 5 years, and you still have no idea.
Basically, no idea who we work for, what we generally write. But again, I mean, one of the most disarming, and this says it all. One of the most disarming things a manager can still do, particularly a top level manager, is call a journalist by his first name.
It's true. Yeah, yeah.
That's all it takes to defang you, Miguel. Just call you Miguel.
If Jurgen Klopp thinks he's got an unfairly tough ride from the people who cover Liverpool day in, day out over the last few years, then that says something about how thin-skinned he's become. Because I think he has, you know, I think he's got a lot of praise, and understandably so, because he's built a really good team. But the tenor of the coverage of Klopp's Liverpool has not been critical.
Oh no!
For him to be as upset as he clearly has been over the last few months by coverage, I think does not reflect well on him.
No,
just on that though.
Yeah,
and Klopp might well refer to this as fake news, but I'm just passing on what I've been told. Some of Klopp's reaction does point to this kind of growing talk that we're now seeing the other side of the coin with Klopp, which is while his personality and all the energy can at one point make a team very good, he's also very difficult and demanding to work for. Some people say that's led to issues in terms of Liverpool's recruitment of staff. And again, obviously there's a bigger context here in how much staff have changed in the last 2 years. And that's feeding into a situation now where almost everything has to be built up again. But also it's also kind of another theory I've been growing with as well, or been developing, where every manager ultimately follows the Jose Mourinho arc. Even those who at one point were considered his great kind of contrasting figures in Klopp and Pep.
So we're in, you see him as being in some kind of terminal Mourinho slide into late career irrelevance.
Not that, more so that they all get so self-involved is probably the wrong word, but they all get, because they've had a certain level of success with their principles, they get so devoted to their principles and what it says about them that a real pride gets into it, and they become increasingly cantankerous and acidic about criticism. I think Guardiola's had a little bit of that as well. And I think, and again, this goes against what I mean. It's only a few years ago where Guardiola and Klopp were being talked about how, you know, they encourage players and motivate them, whereas Mourinho was still of that school of hard knocks, more associated with the early 90s. But given Guardiola's talk about happy flowers this year, given what we're saying here about how Klopp can apparently talk to people, and how one of the lines you hear is players love it and accept it when it's going well, but as soon as it goes bad, it's one of the first things they talk about with Klopp, how difficult he can be. And that follows that same pattern, I think.
We've spoken a lot about how Liverpool basically failed to rebuild when they were on top, and they should have really, in hindsight, dismantled the team in 2020, 2019, and how, you know, Henderson's been there too long, Fabinho's been there too long, Van Dijk's been there too long. Maybe Klopp's been there too long. You know, he's coming up to, what, 8 years in the job now? That's quite a lot. That's a long time to be in such a, you know, high-pressure, public-facing environment.
Jack, Miguel, excellent stuff. Thanks, Emil.
Thank you.
Thanks, lads.
Bang to the head.
This was given to me by one of these guys right here. It was a hell of a rugby player. And they beat the hell out of black and tan.
Defense of the Realmite.
It's the bang to the head.
How many times have you mick bastards been told, eh?
Followed by another bang to the head.
Anyone wearing orange is not welcome in.
Mr. Biden, a quick word for the BBC.
I've not put my hand in my pocket since I left. They paid me £500.
BBC, I'm Irish.
If any fool wants to pay me £500 for gibber and jabber, I'll take his money.
I mentioned the Champions League.
Sorry, if I could just cut in here. I apologise, Owen, for this. I know it's a break with protocol, but there was someone misspoke earlier, a member of the team, and I'd just like to clear it up before the end of the show. Run DMC It's Like That went to number one in 1998. It's true. That was a remix done by Jason Nevins. The original song, of course, came out in 1983. I just felt it was important that I correct the record there. Jason Nevins' take on It's Like That was nevertheless an international smash, selling 5 million copies, writes The Guardian.
Sure, I remember the video. It was Run DMC versus Jason Nevins. It was the dance-off between the boys and the girls. It was awesome.
DMC felt used, pimped and dirty. Milk this cow till there's powdered music coming out the udders. So I'd just like to clarify.
But that's fair.
I was totally unaware of the controversy about that at the time.
I mean, you were in a flow at the time. I was going to jump in immediately, but I just felt, you know,
he got exploited.
Just important.
I mentioned the Champions League earlier. Leeds against Liverpool is also on tonight. So we'll see what happens with that and talk about that tomorrow. We're also going to chat tomorrow about the new Boris Becker movie, Boom Boom, The World versus Boris Becker, on Apple TV. If you have time to watch any of that one in advance, the plan at the moment is to have that chat for Tuesday's podcast. So we'll leave you there. Plenty of football to watch and maybe a little bit of Boris Becker if you have time as well. Thanks, Murph.
Thanks, Ken. And thank you, Ken.
Thank you. Oh, and I think you can.
Wow.
Thanks for listening. Hopefully see you during the week. If you sign up, you will hear all episodes ad-free, if that's the case. The Second Captain's Podcast.
Yeah,
it's part of the Acast Creator Network.
God damn it.
How long is that? That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.